Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. So what if your sugar cravings were more than just a sweet tooth and actually holding you back from clarity, confidence, and true emotional sobriety? This week, we're digging in with Christy Dames, a strategist, speaker, and change maker who spent decades helping high performers unlock their potential by optimizing the brain-body connection. And with over 38 years of sobriety, Christy blends cutting-edge research with lived experience to show us that how we eat affects not just how we feel, but who we're becoming. So from the church basement jelly donut culture of early sobriety to the role of metabolic health in emotional regulation, Christy brings the fire. Get ready to rethink your fuel, reclaim your energy, and redefine recovery. Hi, Christy. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you. So can you take us back to what led you to sobriety?
Yeah. It was a very complex set of things that brought me to sobriety that don't even look like alcoholism, which is a very strange thing. So I found myself in a world where I didn't understand how I belonged, but there was nowhere else to turn. So it seemed right and it fit. But what led me to it was literally lots of trauma as a child. Head traumas, neck traumas, whiplash traumas, birth trauma, you know, cord around the neck, all of those things. And all of those things set me up literally to not have blood flow, oxygen flow. And that was going to be the start of a metabolic mitochondria issue my whole life, and which you couldn't really see. And so then I had all kinds of childhood illnesses, then I had more head traumas. And by the time I picked up a drink around the age of 13, really, that was going to be my medication. It was fabulous. It was like the elixir that would make my physical body, heart, mind, soul, everything come together. Like I was broken in so many places that alcohol made me stick. And that's what I loved. And it wasn't something I wanted all the time. I didn't crave it. I didn't drink to leave, you know, consciousness. I didn't drink to escape. I drank just because it was the thing to do. And I did it. It held me together. And then I could be bigger, more, most. I could be all of who I was. And so that, you know, those pieces were critical. But two other really important environmental pieces that happened that were game changers. One was I graduated from college. I moved into a place in Southern California on the beach. The apartment had tons of black mold that I didn't know about. I'm 21. What do I know about? And so that was serious, serious poisoning for me. I already was challenged. Alcohol held me together and allowed me to be crazy and wild and, you know, have parties, but I was functioning. But when that mold hit, came, boom, game changer. Then I moved to San Francisco. And then the next thing would happen was that when I was around 9, 10, right around there, I'd had a serious head and neck trauma. That was the whiplash. That really did a lot of damage. So I had neurological issues that we couldn't really figure out. Nobody really talked about it. I was the elephant in the living room. And of course, that's going to make alcohol work a lot better. Yeah. And at that point, I was sent to a guy who was a medical doctor at UCSF, and he declared I had this neurologic issue. And so he gave me a diagnosis. So I don't like those things. I know now they're not good. And so he gave me the diagnostic, said, these are the medications that will solve your problem. And unfortunately, he put me through a misdiagnosis of physical things, put me on neuroleptic drugs that literally caused immense damage to me. That for 10 years, I lived in a brownout. For 10 years, I was losing all kinds of things I didn't know I was losing. And it was the biggest challenge of my life. I got sober, even on those things, which was amazing. And 7 years later, something in sobriety, I've been sober almost 38 years. At that point, I took myself off. And this is where the next big shift happened. I took myself off. I did it too fast. I didn't know what I was doing. And literally, I had about 6 month pink cloud. And then suddenly I dove. And it's been a 31 year process of still trying to heal the injuries that happened to my brain from being on those medications. So, and in the middle of all that, you know, finding out that there was no place else to go. Alcohol looked to be the problem. Sure enough, that shift of committing, walking in and saying, holy cow, I think I'm an alcoholic, admitting that allowed me to have this new freedom of a foundation to then chart a new course. And without that, you know, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be here. There's no way, because I wouldn't have had the courage or the clarity to be able to clean up my life and understand what was happening, to then find out what really, really happened. So that's how I got here.
So you get sober from alcohol and the neuroleptics. And I've read that you said sugar was your first addiction. So what did your relationship with food and sugar look like before and after you got sober?
Sugar was fabulous. I mean, that was, you know, as a little kid, I can still remember going into what we called Coke's Market. I grew up in St. Louis, and I grew up in a small area called Frontenac, and there was a beautiful little store where you knew the butcher, you knew the owner, right? But they had a candy section that was unbelievable. And I would gravitate right to sugar all the time. And I know that, and here's one of the reasons I found out way later. So there's glucose and that our brains and our bodies operate on. Well, my brain, which was already starved for oxygen, wanted fuel. That glucose was my fuel. That sucrose was my fuel. And so that would give me all the highs and the highs and the highs. Unfortunately, it was taking my immune system and going lower, lower, lower. So that played a role also, I think, in why I would start to have all kinds of other things like strep throat and all, because all that sugar leads to the body being unable to fight other things. So, but I loved it. And alcohol is sugar. I mean, at its base core, alcohol is sugar. End of day. Like, yeah. So all of us that end up in sobriety have some connection to sugar, glucose, some way that that has played a role, whether we self-medicated, however we did that. And if we learn to self-medicate with sugar, we're going to learn to self-medicate with alcohol. Kind of goes hand in hand.
How did you give up sugar? And was it harder than giving up alcohol?
You know, when I got sober, I was in such a brownout. I literally didn't know anything. I didn't know how to question things. I didn't know that I could. And so when I got sober, I just followed what was in front of me. I had no idea about food, carbohydrate. I had no clue about those things. I didn't know that eating an orange was different than drinking orange juice. I had no clue. And so I I didn't know organic was important. I didn't know any of those things. And in fact, nobody was really talking about a lot of those things way back then. Even though, like, there was two parts of me, the super high functioning. I mean, I was downtown San Francisco opening a hotel. I mean, I was the national sales director to open this new hotel, brand new, hadn't had a hotel built in years. So I'm functioning up here. At the same time, physically and emotionally and mentally, I am way down here. So I would always have to call on that part of me that could make it, the chameleon gal that could make it through anything. And so that sugar part, when I learned literally years later, I would eat bread and donuts and all those things. And then, oh yeah, well, you want to have whole grain. Oh, that's good. So that was kind of that process. But I had the underlying feeling sick all the time thing happening that I couldn't point to until something would catch my attention, go, huh, maybe that donut's not so good. Maybe that bread isn't so good. And that's how I started to experiment. And that's what I did. I experimented piece by piece. And every time I did, and I was talking to someone yesterday, a woman that I'm helping to mentor, who is having a huge crisis in her life right now, all these horrific, hard things happening. And so she has medicated by using some food, but she immediately felt the difference in how bad she feels when she eats sugar amped food and when she doesn't. And she's discovering that the worse she feels, the longer she feels that, the more likely she is to know and remember that feeling, which could lead to the very thing she doesn't want, which is alcohol or a drug. So it's a process of learning, right? You have to learn those things that are working and those that don't.
So why should people in recovery care about metabolic health?
Their metabolic health is, it's like the next level sobriety. It is the thing that really takes you from working through all of your emotional pieces and physically allows you to step up into the next level, which allows the next level emotional stability. And the metabolism, there are a couple ways to look at it. If you look at glucose, like what's my glucose reading? Oh, okay, it's good or it's normal or it's high, and you can track that with a glucose meter every day. But behind that, under the hood, if you will, lives the insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is very tricky because it's a kind of thing that can be building up over time under the hood. You don't see it. Nobody checks for it. I mean, if you really want to know what's going on under the hood, you do a fasting insulin test, right? That will tell you more than anything you can imagine, because then you know what's going on way back here. And so you could be building over time, and suddenly, out of nowhere, you are type 2 diabetic. Like, how'd that happen, right? So that's on the physical scale. Those things build over time. Metabolically, if you go deep into that little cell in our body, you have the mitochondria. That's a little engine in there, right? We have tons of them in cells. They live everywhere except in your blood, but they live in every other cell. The brain is like totally screaming all the time for that. Like, the brain uses all that energy. So if we're feeding the brain the wrong way, then we're not going to get that next level. And then I think part of what happens, and I've seen this happen a lot, we start to think, gee, my sobriety isn't working. Gee, I'm not good enough. Gee, I'm not this or that. But really, that's not what's going on. We are so amazing. Like, every courageous, amazing person, artist on every level, are people who are sober, who have found that peace in them, who had had to take life another way until they didn't anymore. Well, it's kind of with next level sobriety, like, you start to build that strength and you can miss pieces along the way. And I think that metabolic piece that mitochondria engine to be able to understand how do I feed my brain, how do I feed my body, and allow more of who I am to arrive. And I think that's kind of what happens.
So what are some foods that support that mental clarity?
You know, it's so interesting to see where people go with this, because So the first piece I always say is, okay, back off any refined foods, right? Cookies, crackers, anything refined, even if it has really super good stuff in it, just back off it a bit and whole food. Eat an apple, eat an orange, eat some broccoli, or eat some squash. If you're vegan, you're going to do it a different way than if you are carnivore, right? So it's finding the foods that are just whole foods and let them be, because that won't give you the high and the low and the crash like all the other foods. So that's a beautiful place to start. The next place to start is organic food. Oh my gosh. I always go back and I tell people, go look at Environmental Working Group has the top 12 foods that are the most toxic if they're not organic. And the number one food is the strawberry. If you're not eating an organic strawberry, you are taking in glyphosate. You're taking in all kinds of chemicals, which eventually down the road will lead to Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, right? I mean, we know the A to B from a Parkinson's. There's lots of other factors, but we know for sure that there are certain pesticides directly linked to Parkinson's symptoms.
If I'm at the grocery store, I just want to break it down, and I'm looking at the same company, two boxes of strawberries, and one says organic. It's vastly different.
One will give you a poison, and literally those poisons get stuck in the fatty tissues in the body, and they get stored because the body has no idea what to do with that. It's an unfamiliar thing, and the body, so it's going to store it, and it will store it continuously over time. So an Environmental Working Group, they did this years ago. And they also did another study, which many years ago now, I think probably 20, but they looked at all the pesticides that are stored in the cord blood of a baby, right? So woman's pregnant, we got the cord blood, we studied the cord blood afterwards. The cord blood had at least 200 different chemicals. Had Prozac in it, had glyphosate in it, had all kinds of toxic chemicals. So that baby already was loaded with a toxic load that environmentally that child's going to have to navigate. So and those things, they build over time. But when you become sensitive, you know, what sober people have an intuitive, energetic field. And a sense of knowing that happens over time, that you start to feel these subtle things all the time, whether it's a toxic person in your life, toxic food, whatever that is, you will start to sense it. The hard part is being able to navigate to know, oops, I don't want that, and then moving that aside and finding something else, because sometimes sugar's easier. But yeah, that when you go to a store, you want especially fruits and vegetables. Absolutely, you want organic. And a beautiful way to go around that is frozen organic food, fruits are fabulous. The frozen one, they get flash frozen the second they're picked and cleaned. So you're actually going to have a fruit that doesn't sit on a shelf for a long time, might get a little mold in it. You know, that's not going to happen with a frozen fruit. So that's also a way, and sometimes it's easier and it makes smoothies and, you know, and that can be really good. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's actually because I live alone. Anything I'm not going to eat like directly, like an apple, I have frozen, like, so I can cook with. Yeah. Okay. What is your take then on dairy and gluten?
Oh, 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 I was hoping you wouldn't ask. Dairy is so interesting. One of the things I did 30 years ago is there's no autism, none in my family. I don't have a child with it. I don't have it. Like, that's not my world. But I decided to study two things because at the time that I took myself in 7 years sober off of those medications, I got so sick, literally suicidal in sobriety. That's a horrible place to be.
It's horrible.
And so I had to navigate not understanding that the drugs had caused this protracted withdrawal. At that time, I started to have to figure out what was going on. So I started looking back to my childhood to try to understand the brain and the body. And I went over to the world of autism. I had no idea what it was. Well, let me go check it out. It's happening to kids. What is that? Well, I landed in a world of information that I couldn't believe. And I literally, over the course of my life, I look at autism to Alzheimer's. They are the same thing. They just play out differently and over time. So what I learned about dairy in that world was really profound. That dairy, it's an opioid. I mean, it treats our brain like it's an opioid. And so you get it. It gives you a lot of satiation, but it can take you down. And boy, then it can really cause havoc in your emotions if you're sensitive to it in that way. Not everybody is. So then you have dairy, you have organic dairy, and now we have raw dairy, raw, beautiful, organic, raw cow cream, but raw butter. So those things are, raw dairy is different because once it's heated, you actually change the content, the protein, and you change the content of the food, right? So there are advocates for raw dairy. For me, I played with it. Years was off it. Then I would play with it a little bit, have some, see how I did. Sometimes okay, sometimes not. There's also A2 dairy. So there's a farm now, Alexandre Farms, that has an organic A2. So that's a different cow. That's a Guernsey cow. That's totally different. They produce milk that's like goats. Goats are A2 dairy. That dairy is where people have way, way less sensitivity to that protein in that dairy. And so I actually have been making an A2 half and half homemade yogurt to heal the gut. And you can, there's a beautiful guy, Dr. William Davis. He has, he wrote Wheat Belly, and then he wrote another book on healing the gut using different kinds of probiotics that we just don't get anywhere. Then you make your own. I have a little yogurt maker. It's beautiful. So to find ways to do that, again, though, you know, you have to kind of monitor dairy to see if it's working or not. And literally, you can have physical symptoms, gut symptoms. But it's always those emotional ones that are the ones that would catch my attention, right? It's, am I suddenly angry more than normal? Am I responding really fast to something? Am I reacting instead of responding? Is it putting me in jeopardy of, you know, an outburst that I'm going to suddenly be angry at somebody for no reason? So that's kind of that dairy thing I have to play with. The casein part, you know, can really be a problem. And I know... Yeah. There are families, so those women, those mothers that recovered their children from medical autism, right? Those mothers, they went gluten-free, casein-free right away. And those children who lost function over time, when they took dairy away, a couple of days later, the little one would walk into the kitchen, who was a non-speaker, never spoke a word, never said mommy, would come in the kitchen and go, mommy, can I have a glass of orange juice? So those things have happened. And so I always look at what's happening epigenetically and over the course of time, right? So that's how I map it. And then look at our families. Do we have other alcoholics? The ism begin. And when I see a food connection, wow, what does that look like? So on the gluten side, yeah, you know, I took myself off gluten a long, long time ago. And there are several things about gluten. I know people who are gluten-free, sober, gluten-free, cannot eat any kind of gluten product in America. They go to Europe, they go to Paris and have petit croissant, and they are fine. Now, what is up with that? So there are different strains of wheat, but one of the findings too goes back to glyphosate. We have such a tainted food system here with chemicals. The glyphosate that's sprayed, glyphosate can be sprayed on an organic rice in order to dry it out. Glyphosate not only kills the neurological system of a bug that's going to eat a plant, but then it also is a desiccant, so it dries that out. So if it gets sprayed on a grain, it will dry that grain out as well. So, a lot of study and research is done right now that shows that glyphosate piece in wheat is connected to why people are having such a hard time with gluten. Now, you know, wherever you fall on that, for me, I didn't care because I was going organic anyway. I knew that I had a toxic burden that was that unmanageable, right? My life became very unmanageable. And so when I went back and said, nah, you know what? That gluten piece does not work. And the gluten, same thing with that opioid kind of receptor. It can be a drug in and of itself. And once it's refined, that's why I say, just start with a whole food. No matter what you eat whatever you want, more will be revealed. And literally just kind of step out of the refined part. Those two pieces, as much organic as you can, and whole foods, wow. Then you start to have your own wisdom go, huh, okay, I feel a lot better. Oh, wow, I feel just fine. I'm not going to worry about any more food. I'm going to just have my life. And then if something appears, you go, huh, okay, I think I'm going to take that away now. I think I'm going to work with that. And take it a piece at a time. Because once we get that clarity that sobriety delivers, and we do, you can't not get it. You will get that clarity. Sometimes we don't want to know what we're going to find out. Like, there are many things I wish I did not know. I really made my life really hard to know those things. But at the same time, wow, what a game changer to know them. Was the suffering worth it? Well, I don't know that I like suffering on any level that I would even say, oh, it's worth it. But I do know that without the suffering I've had, I wouldn't know what I know. So would I rather be here now? You bet I would. You bet I would.
Oh, no matter what.
Yeah.
So how can we tell the difference between emotional and physical hunger? And when I'm hungry is when I make the worst food decisions.
Hunger is a really interesting piece for me. And so where I am, my husband coined me the 1% gal. I'm where everybody has a reaction in one way. 99% all have the same thing. I don't. I am a 1% rule where what works for everybody didn't work for me. And it's horrible. I hate that. But the what was interesting for me is because of all the trauma that I had, physical trauma that changed my body, which made alcohol and medications and a little bit of drug here and there work so well, that piece literally broke my body in half. And so I have lived with lots of chronic pain my entire life. When I went off the medications and food became the thing that could give me support and sustenance, not understanding anything about it, I developed huge abdominal solar plexus pain. So I lost my ability to understand what was a real hunger, physical hunger, and what was not. And so navigating that piece for all those years was really, really hard because I didn't know that, am I really hungry? Well, I would only know if I was hungry if I didn't have food for about 12 hours. Right? That's, I would feel a different kind of hunger. Now, that led me to really having to pull apart, gee, am I hungry? Gee, every time I eat, I get into more pain. Food became my enemy. There were times when without anything to take away the pain, nothing. I couldn't drink over it. I couldn't do anything over it. That physical pain would be exhausting. So I would reach out for a food that I thought would make me feel better, even mm-hmm. if I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so I had to really discern over time, is this hunger or not? And then I had to say, okay, well, no food is giving me what I want. All food seems to be my enemy. So what's the best thing I can do mm-hmm. for me in this moment? And if I was emotionally reacting to something, I would have to catch that. I would have to go, I'm really, really angry. I'm not angry from what happened today. I might be angry from what happened yesterday, right? I might also be responding or reacting to a food I had 4 days ago. And this is, I wanted to just say this quickly. You can have dairy on a Monday and you'll be fine Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And Thursday, you're a mess. You are in a toxic overload and you don't understand why. You're feeling emotionally drained and damaged. And it's the 4 days later that the dairy caught up to you that nailed you. So that's why food, yeah, it may not happen in day one, but when it happens, mm-hmm. it happens. And so to just be conscious of what could be driving it. I used to say to people, young women that I've worked with for all the years, like, whose drink are you drinking anyway? Is this your drink that you're having to drink for you? Are you drinking your parents' drink? Are you drinking your grandparents' drink, right? So the same kind of thing with food. What am I eating over? Is this me? Am I eating to medicate? Am I eating what they ate? You know, how, just always looking back, like, what is the process of how I got here? When we're hungry, I think it's kind of like, when I first heard this, when I first got sober, it was the best. If I want to have a drink today, just don't do that. Put it off till tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That is the best tool in my kit.
Best.
Right? Wait till tomorrow. I'll have that drink tomorrow. I will be a different person then, and we'll see what happens. Same thing with the food, right? I will. Oh, wow. I really want to have that cake. And I want that piece of cake right now. And I could be here in Los Angeles. We have a store called Erewhon. Oh,
yeah.
It's ridiculous. I mean, people all over the world know about it. They come just to take selfies at Erewhon, right? It's insane. But they have all organic everything everywhere. I mean, it's so beautiful to walk into a place where all the food in the cafe, if you eat beef, it's all organic, grass-fed, right? Mm-hmm. The fish is wild-caught. The vegetables, organic. They don't use seed oils. They do all the right pieces.
Yeah.
Right? And so I can walk in there and think, oh, gee, I'm going to, you know, I don't care. I'll eat anything. I'll blow it because I'll go in there. Yeah. But I could go in there and say, oh, it's okay if I have this piece of cake. It has all the right things in it. Right? Mm-mm. Because if I'm picking that up to medicate myself, then I'm going to feel that after effect, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, you know, and then it will make me feel bad about myself. And when I feel bad about myself, I can start to go down, into the hole. And then when you go there, you start to think all kinds of things that are not true. And that's the piece. It's to never let ourselves be allowed to get to the point where we start to think things about ourselves that are untrue, that we think that we're, you know, worthless, we're nothing, we're the hole in the donut, right? We're all those things.
Yeah.
We're not. And all the work we've done to build up to that place, and then we let it go. That's where we have to catch it. And hunger, real hunger, it can be that pivot point when you have time that becomes very complex. And you're like, well, I'm sober a long time. I'm sober 3 years, 5, 10, 20, 38. Like, oh yeah, that doesn't matter for me, but it does. Making a right choice from consciousness, because we have it now, is the key. And it's just connecting. And then if we do the thing that we don't want to do, we say, that's okay. I did that today. I won't do that tomorrow. Same process, right? I'll wait till tomorrow. I can let myself go today. Tomorrow, yeah. I won't.
Yeah. So we're talking about things that block people from mental clarity, and you work with a lot of high-level performers. How do you help people identify their hidden blocks?
You know, it's been an amazing, amazing road that I've been on. And in working with some super high performer clients and finding myself at different stages and moments of history, that how did I get there, right? Like how did I end up working with Steve Jobs when he came back to Apple to launch the first ever iMac? How did I find myself in a room with Phil Donahue hanging out talking about food and looking at organics and food and farming? How did that happen, right? And then working with human-centered designers over time, who were literally launching new vehicles that were game changers for the planet. How did that happen? And so the walk of sobriety, I believe, because my two missions were clarity and freedom. And I didn't know what either one looked like. So my constant search for those two things led me to work with people in a way that would allow them to also find their clarity and freedom. And it's really something, because when you sit with someone face to face, you will start to unpack more of who they are. And I brought my crazy California toolkit to places where you would not think it would work, right? Crazy California toolkit. I would bring essential oils into clients' offices, right? Like, I'm like, okay, it's a CEO, like, yeah, whatever. But the way engaging first to talk about who they are, and literally, I always talk about the three moves. It takes three moves to either do the right thing or the wrong thing. In three moves, you can get someone to either open, and you don't know what they are when you go in. And that's where the intuition of sobriety is critical, because you walk in and you allow that part of yourself to be present for the person in front of you, and then you start to find that path. And so when I work with folks, it was always about really getting to that deeper part of who they are, whether they had alcohol issues or not, or no matter what it was, self-esteem issues, all the issues end up being pretty much on the same playing field. But it's allowing a safety place, what happens when you get sober, to arrive, so that in three moves that you don't think you have, but they will arrive, to unlock the piece that's holding someone back from having their real voice, their true voice. What is that voice? And so you can find it pretty quickly if you're just present for that person. And that's the beauty, I think, of different ways of approaching sobriety. You have 12 steps, you have, you know, working with someone to allow a safe space to be able to dump your stuff and be able to heal from that, whatever that trauma is, in the past, other ways, and therapy, whatever way, family constellations. I use that work a lot to understand where breakages in a family, in a system, have occurred. So a person in a company, what is the system they're operating in? What is keeping them stuck? What broken pieces do they have that need to arrive in a way to help them step into more of who they are? So I will use any tool in my kit to help that person literally come back to clarity, consciousness, finding the block, then either removing that block or allowing that block to just be sidestepped over here, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is the block, if we move, like, we know Steve Jobs was pretty health conscious. And so when we, if we move to talking instead about food, about environmental toxins, what, can you share a few of the top environmental toxins we should be aware of?
Yeah, the, I think there are really the top three, I would say. The first one is PFAS, PFAS and PFOA. That is the forever chemical, that lives everywhere. It's everywhere. And that toxin is so pervasive. It's in our water. It's everywhere. Mark Ruffalo has done a beautiful movie. I think it's called Dark Waters. When you watch that film, you understand the walk that a lawyer named Rob Ballot, who was featured in the New York Times years ago, all about PFAS. Because this guy, similar to other people like Aaron Brockovich, totally uncovered what was happening with this toxic chemical. And there are beautiful people, like there's a woman, Mama Vation. Oh, I love this woman. Mama Vation, Leah Segedy. Leah has a website where it's all PFAS. So she has all the cookware, good, better, best, right? So you can see the PFAS-free everything. And there's also another, I think it's called PFAS Central. There's another woman, Green Chemistry, Arlene Blum. And she now has, she's featured in Forbes, I think weekly or monthly. She is amazing in the work that she's done around PFAS, because it's in our carpets, our furniture, our clothing, our food, our water. And it is a super uber toxin. So you want to make sure you have as much of that away from your life as possible. That's number one.
So full disclosure, one of our sponsors is True Diagnostic, and they sent me a test. And I did the test, and I was high in the forever chemicals. And I, of all the things, was like, I don't know what to do about that. Honestly, like I was like, oh, looked at all the results. Like there's like 100 different biomarkers. And I was like, great, I can work on this. I can work on my lung health. I can work. I didn't know when I looked, I just kind of like glanced over it. I saw it in the high range, but said like, what am I doing? And so I didn't, this is crazy. I did not know that you could do something about the forever chemicals. I thought it was, well, it's just in the water. Or it's just in the air.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's. And oh my gosh, I remember I'm trying to buy every single thing that didn't have PFAS in it. Yeah. And so the first part is distance is always your friend, right? Distance to anything. So even with cell phones, distance to a cell phone, really key. Like when I speak on a cell phone, I either have it on speaker or I have my earplugs in, but I never, ever hold that phone in my hand at my head. No way. That's the second toxin right there. Those toxins from cell phones and what we now know about that is really important. There's beautiful, brilliant work done by a woman, Magda Havas, in Europe, and also by Devra Davis. And Devra, she has Environmental Health Trust. Devra was the first, she was in the Clinton administration, and Devra's the one that came out and said, oh, we have a big problem with EMF and radiation, non-natural EMF, radiation poisoning. At the head, I mean, we now know it opens the calcium ion channel. So that PFAS that we might have in our body might not have easy access to the brain. But when you hold a cell phone to your head, after 2 minutes, that part of the brain heats up, you start to open that calcium ion channel, and boom, any toxin in the body can now flow to the brain. So especially with Wi-Fi, like Wi-Fi important. If you have Wi-Fi in your home, turn that puppy off at night. Don't sleep with Wi-Fi on. Don't sleep with a phone by your head. Have a safe space for your system to repair when you sleep. A number one critical. And people who are sober, again, sober people are more sensitive to, we are the sensitives. We are the empaths. We are the canaries in the coal mine. So if we're getting poisoned when we sleep, our repair mechanism not working. Our parasympathetic system's not shutting down. So we're in sympathetic overdrive. We wake up, we got the phone, we're checking stuff, but we're never resting and getting to repair. So it's very simple. Don't put a lit phone to your head. Don't put a lit phone on your body. Make sure you got a case on it. Put it in airplane. Turn it on when you got to connect with somebody or check things, email, phone, social media, whatever it is. But just don't have it lit on your body. And turn that Wi-Fi off at night. Absolutely. Turn that off.
Wow. And you know, that would be hard for some people.
Oh.
So my next question was, how can you start shifting to a low tox lifestyle?
It really takes commitment, and it takes just understanding a few things. Like people get problems and symptoms over time. And the longer you have things building that you're not paying attention to, you end up with a diagnostic word that you're told you have. The second you're told you have Alzheimer's, early onset dementia, Parkinson's, cancer, lupus, whatever that is, you've been in a process a long time. If one just starts to step back enough from those toxins, and I mean all that toxin world, you will automatically halt the progression of things that are going to take you down a road you don't want to end up in later, right? You don't want to end up with the word that tells you you have this. And that's the key. And if you just start with a few things, and in the world that we live in now, the toxic soup, if you will, if you do a few things, one, to lower that load, wow, I'm going to eat as organic as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, and you just eat as best as you can and be conscious of it, right? You start there. And then number two, take away those electromagnetic fields that are causing shifts in the body, which especially Wi-Fi in your home. It's like, it's all about proximity. What's closest to you, right? Well, my cell phone closest. So I'm going to keep that as far away as I can. And that will give me distance. Proximity in my home, Wi-Fi. I'm going to turn that off at night. You can even get devices today that have little switches that will turn it off for you. We're going to turn it off at 8 o'clock at night, and it won't go on till 6 the next morning. Wow, that's beautiful. I'm going to use blue light blocking glasses at night. I'm going to use. So here's a little trick. Red lights, red, the color red, they don't have any of that, any blue light in them, right? So in a bedroom, you might have only red lights at night. So if you're reading a book before you go to bed, you've got red light on. That's not stimulating the part of your brain that is going to turn on. In your bathrooms, you can have little night lights that are red lights. So all those little hacks along the way help to, you become your own biohacker, right? You become your own neurohacker, and you allow your brain to have that rest. And so you can just do a couple of things that just allow the brain to stay in that place of healing. And if you get up in the night, whether you're going to the bathroom or your baby in the other room is crying, whatever it is, you have red lights on. Nobody is going to get the blue light hit. You won't get it. Mom, dad, the baby, nobody gets a blue light hit. And so your circadian rhythm is not going to be disrupted at that time. So you're just doing a few little things that allow the brain to stay calm.
Yeah. I will say, I started dating after being married, well, being with my ex for 18 years. If I put some red lights in my bedroom, I think it would send the wrong message. If I walked into some guy's room and there were red lights on, he better say, it's because it's healthier.
It's for my brain.
It's for my brain. Christy, thank you so much. I learned, seriously, learned so much. Can you tell us if any of our listeners want to work with you or follow you? Where can they find you?
Well, I'm just getting ready to launch a whole new world of stuff. And so right now I'm in stealth mode. The best place to reach me right now would be at my Proton Mail, which is my name, Christy Dames at protonmail.com. So CHRISTIEDAMES.
Okay. Maybe you'll come back and tell us about what you've been working on.
I would love to. I would love to. I love your programs, what you're doing, how you're doing it, what you're bringing to people. It's amazing. So I'm so grateful you're doing your work out there. It's really important.
Thank you so much, Christy. And thank you all for listening to Sisters in Sobriety. And we will see you next week.
Take care.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.